the midnight meat train, Leon Kaufman was no longer new to the city. The Palace of Delights, he'd always called it, in the days of his innocence. But that was when he'd lived in Atlanta, and New York was still a kind of promised land, where anything and everything was possible. Now Kaufman had lived 3.5 months, in his dream city, and the Palace of Delights seemed less than delightful. Was it really only a season, since he stepped out of Port Authority bus station, and looked up 42nd Street, toward the Broadway intersection? So short a time, to lose so many treasured illusions. He was embarrassed now even to think of his naivete. It made him wince to remember how he had stood and announced aloud, "New York, I love you." Love? Never. It had been at best an infatuation. And now, after only 3 months, living with his object of adoration, spending his days and nights in her presence, she had lost her aura of perfection. New York was just a city. He had seen her wake in the morning like a slot and pick murdered men from between her teeth and suicides from the tangles of her hair. He had seen her late at night, her dirty back streets shamelessly courting depravity. He had watched her in the hot afternoon, sluggish and ugly, indifferent to the atrocities that were being committed every hour in her throttled passages. It was no palace of delights. It bred death, not pleasure. Everyone he met had brushed with violence. It was a fact of life. It was almost cheap to have known someone who had died a violent death. It was proof of living in that city. But Kaufman had loved New York from afar for almost 20 years. He'd planned his love affair for most of his adult life. It was not easy, therefore, to shake the passion off as though he had never felt it. There were still times, very early, before the cop sirens began, or at twilight, when Manhattan was still a miracle. For those moments, and for the sake of his dreams, he still gave her the benefit of the doubt, even when her behavior was less than ladylike. She didn't make such forgiveness easy. In the few months that Kaufman had lived in New York, her streets had been awash with spilled blood. In fact, it was not so much the streets themselves, but the tunnels beneath those streets. "Subway slaughter" was the catchphrase of the month. Only the previous week, another 3 killings had been reported. The bodies had been discovered in one of the subway cars on the Avenue of the Americas, hacked open and partially disemboweled, as though an efficient abattoir operative had been interrupted in his work. The killings were so thoroughly professional that the police were interviewing every man on their records who had some past connection with the butchery trade. The meat packaging plants on the waterfront were being watched, the slaughterhouses scoured for clues. A swift arrest was promised, though none was made. This recent trio of corpses was not the first to be discovered in such a state. The very day that Kaufman had arrived, a story had broken in the Times that was still the talk of every morbid secretary in the office. The story went that a German visitor, lost in the subway system, late at night, had come across a body in a train. The victim was a well-built, attractive 30-year-old woman from Brooklyn. She had been completely stripped. Every shred of clothing, every article of jewelry, even the studs in her ears. More bizarre than the stripping was the neat and systematic way in which the clothes had been folded and placed in individual plastic bags on the seat beside the corpse. This was no irrational slasher at work. This was a highly organized mind, a lunatic with a strong sense of tidiness. Further, and yet more bizarre than the careful stripping of the corpse, was the outrage that had then been perpetrated upon it. The reports claimed, though the police department failed to confirm this, that the body had been meticulously shaved. Every hair had been removed. From the head, from the groin, from beneath the arms. All cut and scorched back to the flesh. Even the eyebrows and eyelashes had been plucked out. Finally, the sole too naked slab had been hung by the feet from one of the holding handles set in the roof of the car, and a black plastic bucket, lined with a black plastic bag, had been placed beneath the corpse to catch the steady fall of blood from its wounds. In that state, stripped, shaved, suspended and practically bled white, the body of Loretta Dyer had been found. It was disgusting, it was meticulous, and it was deeply confusing. There had been no rape, nor any sign of torture. The woman had been swiftly and efficiently dispatched as though she was a piece of meat. And the butcher was still loose. The city fathers, in their wisdom, declared a complete close down on press reports of the slaughter. It was said that the man who had found the body was in protective custody in New Jersey, out of sight of inquiring journalists. But the cover-up had failed. Some greedy cop had leaked the salient details to a reporter from the Times. Everyone in New York now knew the horrible story of the slaughters. It was a topic of conversation in every deli and bar. And of course, on the subway. But Loretta Dyer was only the first. Now three more bodies had been found in identical circumstances, though the work had clearly been interrupted on this occasion. Not all the bodies had been shaved, and the jugulars had not been severed to bleed them. There was another, more significant difference in the discovery. It was not a tourist who had stumbled on the site, it was a reporter from the New York Times. Kaufman surveyed the report that sprawled across the front page of the newspaper. He had no prurient interest in the story, unlike his elbow mate along the counter of the deli. All he felt was a mild disgust that made him push his plate of overcooked eggs aside. It was simply further proof of his city's decadence. He could take no pleasure in her sickness. Nevertheless, being human, he could not entirely ignore the gory details on the page in front of him. The article was sensationally written, but the simple clarity of the style made the subject seem more appalling. He couldn't help wondering, too, about the man behind the atrocities. Was there one psychotic loose, or several, each inspired to copy the original murder? Perhaps this was only the beginning of the horror. Maybe more murders would follow, until at last the murderer, in his exhilaration or exhaustion, would step beyond caution and be taken. Until then, the city, Kaufman's adored city, would live in a state somewhere between hysteria and ecstasy. At his elbow, a bearded man knocked over Kaufman's coffee. "Sheet," he said. Kaufman shifted in his stool to avoid the dribble of coffee running off the counter. "Sheet," the man said again. "No harm done," said Kaufman. He looked at the man with a slightly disdainful expression on his face. The clumsy bastard was attempting to soak up the coffee with a napkin, which was turning to mush as he did so. Kaufman found himself wondering if the soap, with his florid cheeks and his uncultivated beard, was capable of murder. Was there any sign on that overfed face, any clue in the shape of his head, or the turn of his small eyes, that gave his true nature away? The man spoke. "Want another?" Kaufman shook his head. "Coffee. Regular." "Dark," the oaf said to the girl behind the counter. She looked up from cleaning the grill of cold fat. "Huh? Coffee? You deaf?" The man grinned at Kaufman. "Deaf," he said. Kaufman noticed he had three teeth missing from his lower jaw. "Looks bad, huh?" he said. What did he mean? The coffee? The absence of his teeth? Three people like that. Carved up. Kaufman nodded. "Makes you think," he said. "Sure. I mean, it's a cover-up, isn't it? They know who did it. This conversation's ridiculous," thought Kaufman. He took off his spectacles and pocketed them. The bearded face was no longer in focus. That was some improvement at least. "Bastards," he said. "Fucking bastards, all of them. I'll lay you anything, it's a cover-up." "A what?" "They got the evidence. They're just keeping us in the fucking dark. There's something out there that's not human." Kaufman understood. It was a conspiracy theory the oaf was trotting out. He'd heard them so often. A panacea. See, they do all this cloning stuff, and it gets out of hand. They could be going fucking monsters for all we know. There's something down there they won't tell us about. Cover up, like I say. Play you anything. Kaufman found the man's certainty attractive. Monsters on the prowl. Six heads, a dozen eyes. Why not? He knew why not. Because that excused his city. That let her off the hook. And Kaufman believed in his heart that the monsters, to be found in the tunnels, were perfectly human. The bearded man threw his money on the counter, and got up, sliding his fat bottom off the stained plastic stool. Probably a fucking cop, he said, as his partum shot. Tried to make a fucking hero, made a fucking monster instead. He grinned grotesquely. Play you anything, he continued, and lumbered out without another word. Kaufman slowly exhaled through his nose, feeling the tension in his body abate. He hated that sort of confrontation. It made him feel punted and ineffectual. Come to think of it, he hated that kind of man. The opinionated brute that New York bred so well. It was coming up to six when Mahogany woke. The morning rain had turned into a light drizzle by twilight. There was about as clear smelling as it ever got in Manhattan. He stretched on his bed, threw off the dirty blanket, and got up for work. In the bathroom the rain was dripping in the box of the air conditioner, filling the apartment with a rhythmical slapping sound. Mahogany turned on the television, to cover the noise, uninterested in anything it had to offer. He went to the window. The street 6 floors below was thick with traffic and people. After a hard day's work, New York was on its way home. To play, to make love. People were streaming out of their offices and into their automobiles. Some would be testy after a day's sweaty labor in a badly aired office. Others, benign as sheep, would be wandering home down the avenues, ushered along by a ceaseless current of bodies. Still others would even now be cramming into the subway, blind to the graffiti on every wall, deaf to the babble of their own voices, and to the cold thunder of the tunnels. It pleased Mahogany to think of that. He was, after all, not one of the common herd. He could stand at his window and look down on 1,000 heads below him and know he was a chosen man. He had deadlines to meet, of course, like the people in the street. But his work was not their senseless labor. It was more like a sacred duty. He needed to live, and sleep, and cheat like them too. But it was not financial necessity that drove him, but the demands of history. He was in a great tradition that stretched further back than America. He was a night stalker. Like Jack the Ripper, like Gil D. Ray, a living embodiment of death, a wraith with a human face. He was a haunter of sleep, and an awakener of terrors. The people below him could not know his face, nor would care to look twice at him. But his stare caught them, and weighed them up, selecting only the ripest from the passing parade, choosing only the healthy and the young to fall under his sanctified knife. Sometimes Mahogany longed to announce his identity to the world, but he had responsibilities, and they bore on him heavily. He couldn't expect fame. His was a secret life, and it was merely pride that longed for recognition. After all, he thought, does the beef salute the butcher as it throbs to its knees? All in all, he was content. To be part of that great tradition was enough, would always have to remain enough. Recently, however, there had been discoveries. They weren't his fault, of course. Nobody could possibly blame him. But it was a bad time. Life was not as easy as it had been 10 years ago. He was that much older, of course, and that made the job more exhausting. And more the obligations weighed on his shoulders. He was a chosen man, and that was a difficult privilege to live with. He wondered, now and then, if it wasn't time to think about training a younger man for his duties. There would need to be consultations with the fathers, but sooner or later a replacement would have to be found, and it would be, he felt, a criminal waste of his experience not to take on an apprentice. There were so many felicities he could pass on. The tricks of his extraordinary trade. The best way to stalk, to cut, to strip, to bleed. The best meat for the purpose. The simplest way to dispose of the remains. So much detail, so much accumulated expertise. Mahogany wandered into the bathroom and turned on the shower. As he stepped in, he looked down at his body. The small paunch, The graying hairs on his sagging chest, the scars and pimples that littered his pale skin. He was getting old. Still tonight, like every other night, he had a job to do. Kaufman hurried back into the lobby with his sandwich, turning down his collar and brushing rain off his hair. The clock above the elevator at 7:16. He would work through until 10, no later. The elevator took him up to the 12th floor and to the Pappas offices. He traipsed unhappily through the maze of empty desks and hooded machines to his little territory, which was still illuminated. The women who cleaned the offices were chatting down the corridor. Otherwise the place was lifeless. He took off his coat, shook the rain off it as best he could, and hung it up. Then he sat down in front of the piles of orders he had been tussling with for the best part of 3 days, and began work. It would only take one more night's labor, he felt sure, to break the back of the job, and he found it easier to concentrate without the incessant clatter of typists and typewriters on every side. He unwrapped his ham on whole wheat with extra mayonnaise and settled in for the evening. It was 9 now. Mahogany was dressed for the night shift. He had his usual sober suit on with his brown tie, neatly knotted, his silver cufflinks a gift from his first wife, placed in the sleeves of his immaculately pressed shirt, his thinning hair gleaming with oil, his nails snipped and polished, his face flushed with cologne. His bag was packed. The towels, the instruments, his chainmail apron. He checked his appearance in the mirror. He could, he thought, still be taken for a man of 45, 50 at the outside. As he surveyed his face, he reminded himself of his duty. Above all, he must be careful. There would be eyes on him, every step of the way, watching his performance tonight, and judging it. He must walk out like an innocent, arousing no suspicion. If they only knew, he thought. The people who walked, ran and skipped past him, on the streets. Who collided with him, without apology. Who met his gaze with contempt. Who smiled at his bulk, looking uneasy in his ill-fitting suit. If only they knew what he did, what he was and what he carried. Caution, he said to himself, and turned off the light.